another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter.
Hi, folks, this is Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, coming to you once again from Arlington, Texas, with episode 399, which means tomorrow is going to be our 400th episode, which is really awesome because it's going to lead us to our 500th episode, which I think is going to really be a landmark. But I'm going to clue you in early. I'm going to do something tomorrow. I'm going to give away some stuff tomorrow, so you'll want to make sure you tune in tomorrow as early as possible. Pay attention to your iTunes alert or whatever, your blog alert, however you get your feed reader, whatever it is you use to keep an eye on the Survival Podcast. I'm going to give away quite a bit of stuff tomorrow in honor of our 400th episode, so make sure you tune in. All right, but moving on, what is today's show going to be about? Today's show is going to be about attracting wildlife to your property. And if you saw the title before you did the download, hopefully you noticed, in quotes, a new look at attracting, quote, wildlife, unquote, to your property. Now, what does that mean? I'll tell you when we get into the main body of today's show, but what I'm going to say in the introduction section is that mainly when people start thinking about attracting wildlife, they think about higher animal species, squirrels, songbirds, and things like that. And if you live somewhere out in the country, maybe you're thinking rabbits, deer, turkey, if you have enough property and some water on it, waterfowl like ducks and geese. Today we're going to go lower than that, quite a bit lower, and we'll kind of work up to the bottom edge of those types of animals. And I think it'll be an interesting look, and it'll make you take a new look at your property. It's especially going to help people that live in urban and suburban environments that have a little small postage stamp lots that think, oh, there's only so much that I can do. I'm going to give you a new way to look at your property. And if you have a huge piece of property, 5 acres like I do, or 500 acres, it's going to be beneficial as well. So hopefully everybody will enjoy today's show. Before we get into the main topic deeply, though, let's go ahead and knock out our housekeeping. Housekeeping item one, as always, let's take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to take care of you. Sponsor of the day number one, Western Botanicals, a great source of all things herbal and all things alternative health. Check them out. Their herbs are all either wildcrafted or certified organic, one or the other. A lot of the stuff is wildcrafted, which means there is no organic certification for something that's harvested from the wild. But check them out. They have not just a tremendous selection of stuff, but a tremendous amount of information. Moving on, our next sponsor of the day is Common Sense Prep. Exactly what it says, exactly what it promises, that's what it delivers. Common sense things to help you stay prepared. I just picked up something today on their website that I thought was really cool. I've seen it advertised in a few places. I got a great price on it. I think it was $27. I ordered it right before I started today's show, and it's called the SR3 Fire Knife. And it's basically a knife that holds a flint steel on the back end of it, and it's a folding knife. So it fits, you know, small in your hand, in your pocket, can even go on a key ring. And it's a great way to have a knife and a fire-starting tool wherever you go. I'll be doing a review of it once it shows up, putting it on the YouTube channel. But these guys are new. They're just getting started, and every little order helps. I know how hard it was when I started out. So consider going by Common Sense Prep today. Check out their products. Look at their fire-starting tools and take a look at that. If you need a fire-starting tool, consider one of these. I think they're a pretty good little item. Moving on from there, I want to remind everybody that in the Members Support Brigade, we just added a new discount partner. And even if you're not Members Brigade, I'm going to kind of give these guys kind of a little mini-sponsored mention today. The company is called Honeyville Grains, and they have everything you could want to help kind of shore up your prepping from a long-term storage need. They have an amazing assortment of dehydrated vegetables and fruits. What I really love that they provide, though, are dehydrated cheese powder, egg, milk, and butter. And I actually use specifically the cheese and the eggs all the time. I don't just use them for a prep. They're very, very affordable. They have a great shipping policy. It's $4.59 or $4.20, whatever it is. It's $4 and some odd cents for your order, no matter how big it is. So you could order a pallet of stuff. It's $4 to ship it to you. if you're in the MSB, you get 10% off of Honeyville. So even if you're not in the MSB, I really recommend you check them out. I'll have a link to them in today's show notes. Additionally, if you're in the MSB, I really recommend you take advantage of the discount. At 10% is pretty good. Joe posted in the forum yesterday, I think it was, I'm not sure which Joe it was, but one of the Joes, and he said he just bought 100 pounds of spring wheat, and with his discount, it came out to 92 cents a pound. He can't buy it at his local co-op for that price, and here it's going to be delivered to his door. So check those guys out. Also, please get involved with us on the web. We have a lot of ways you can do that. We have a YouTube channel. We have a Facebook fan page. And, of course, we have our forum. Please join our forum. I'll leave it at that today. I mentioned the MSV, so I'll just leave it at, hey, if you want to support the show at 20 cents an episode and get great benefits like the Honeyville discount and discounts to 15 other vendors and some videos and some other stuff, consider joining the MSV, which, again, is the Members Support Brigade. You'll find information about that on the site. Now let's get into the main topic of today's show. I think to help get, help you get the most out of this show and to really understand its value, we have to set the mood. So the first question I have for you is, why do we as humans, and not just you, because this is a fact, human beings want wild things around us. We desire them around us. Now, there are the people that are completely citified. Citified people that are out there in the city, and they really don't want much of anything other than maybe a tree here or there growing up between the sidewalk. And any bug or any crawly thing or any little animal is kind of like, yeah, I don't want anything to do with that. I think those people are living a lie. And I think as soon as you take those people out of those environments, whatever fear has been put into their life due to that sterility of that environment is taken away, that they revert to a natural state. So when we look at everybody other than that small group of people, we see a constant that people want wild things around us. If you don't believe that, it's springtime throughout the South. I know up north you're a month away from it yet, really, in a lot of places. But if you're anywhere south of the Mason-Dixon line, especially when you get way down here to Texas and Alabama and Arkansas and places like that, if you doubt that, go by a Home Depot or a Lowe's and go to the garden section on a weekend. I drove by and wouldn't go near the place, Home Depot, this Sunday. It looked like Six Flags Over Texas's parking lot. It looked like an amusement park. Now, why is that? Because it's everybody out there buying stuff, and unfortunately, very few of them are buying vegetables, but I'm seeing more and more of that, so that's encouraging. But most of the people out there are buying flowers and bushes and trees and stuff like that to plant. Now, those are all wild things. So what we see is a constant. Every major city has a zoo. Most Americans keep a pet of some type or another, whether it's a goldfish or a dog. The first thing people think about when they move into a house with any type of property attached to it all anywhere is what they're going to plant. So we know that human beings desire wild things around us. What I want to ask you is, why? Why is that the case? I think it's simply because it's our natural state. That we, whether you are a creationist or an evolutionist, I don't want you to be offended by this word I'm about to use. We evolved over thousands and thousands and thousands of years as part of the planet and as part of the ecosystems and within and surrounded by wild things. We are now at this point genetically predisposed to have a desire to be surrounded by wild things. And what I mean by not being, if you're a creationist and you believe God created man out of the sand and the soil and Adam was the first man and you believe that, that's fine. You can believe that. Regardless of whether it's that way or it's pure evolution or it's something in between like intelligent design, doesn't matter. Once people were on the planet and left to ourselves to spread out, we went through an evolutionary process that is inherent to all creatures by being bred over periods of time and into different environments. And that process has been mostly at a time when we were surrounded by wild things. It's only recently, it's the way Ron Hood describes it, if we take the entire human history and lay it out in a 10-foot line, it's less than a quarter inch at the end that represents modern times, where things are the way they are now. So we have that 9 foot 11 and 3/4 inches of history behind us, and we only have a quarter inch of modern times. And even in those modern times, we have done everything we can to continue to be surrounded by wild things. Isn't that interesting? So once we understand that we have this desire, we realize that a big piece of what's missing for most people isn't whether or not these creatures and these things are around us, because they certainly are. There's animals and there's life everywhere on this planet. We almost, you know, despite what I think are some really concerted efforts, can't extinguish life on the planet. It continues to evolve and thrive. And there are wild creatures everywhere we look. If we have as much of a blade of grass, there's something living underneath it or behind it. So I think it's important that as I go through this today, we start to think about observation. And it's amazing how little life you can see in a backyard. You can look out, you can see some bushes and some plants and some trees, and maybe a squirrel on a squirrel feeder and a couple birds, and think, well, that's the extent of the life out there. But as we start going through what I call lower trophic levels, or what I call, what biology calls lower trophic levels today, you'll see that if we just start to observe how much life is really out there. So we have to start out with one overriding concept that is completely logical but almost always overlooked by anybody that starts to think about maybe making their backyard a little bit more friendly to wildlife. And that is that all life is dependent upon solar energy. In fact, all life is nothing but a giant solar collector. You are a giant solar collector. You may not believe me, but you are. You may think, well, you can put me in a dark room, completely shelter out all light. As long as I'm fed and given water, I'll survive. I certainly want the solar energy, but I could live in the darkness if I had to. Just frankly, I don't want to be there. But the reality is you're still a solar collector even in that environment, because you have to be fed, as we just discussed. Now, what are you going to eat? You're going to eat either your plant life, which was dependent upon photosynthesis from the sun, or you're going to eat animals that somewhere in their trophic level, and a trophic level is just if we look at something, for instance, how many insects does it take to feed a frog, and how many frogs does it take to feed a snake, and if something predates on that snake, like a bird of prey, how many snakes does it take to feed that bird of prey? And we have multiple trophic levels, and some creature might be part of many trophic pyramids. But somewhere in that squirrel that you're eating or that cow that you're eating, there is an herbivore that has to eat. So we realize that every single creature on the planet is dependent upon solar energy. And once we realize that, it's not a big leap to understand that most animals are, in a way, herbivores. In other words, we all are vegetarians. Now, I know you're thinking, I'm not a vegetarian, Jack. I eat meat all the time. Well, so do I. But just as I just said, all the meat that we eat is somewhere at the bottom of the food chain consuming plant life. So we realize that all life comes from plants. And without plants, we couldn't have any of the things that we have. That all the wildlife that we want to attract to our property starts with plants. But it's even further down than that. It's much further down than that. The one thing that plants need, with very few exceptions, there's some weird algae that grows, you know, like against, you know, sulfur vents on the ocean floor where the acid's high and nobody thought anything could live because it was too hot and too low of oxygen and too little light, but yet this stuff lives there. With the exception of some weird stuff like that, the one thing that all plants need is soil. So it took me a long time to get here, but I hope that I've driven the background hard enough that you'll understand why. If we want to really attract wildlife to our property, the place that we have to start is with our soil. And there's a constant in permaculture that we don't feed plants. So when we go out, we say we're putting fertilizer on, or we're bringing in, you know, manure, or compost, or mulching, and we're trying to get a fertilizer-type activity, and we're putting it around a peach tree. We're not feeding the peach tree. We're feeding the soil, and the peach tree grows within and in between the particles of soil, and it takes from the soil what it needs. So we feed soil. We build soil. So if we want to attract wildlife to our property, it might sound crazy, but where we have to start is with our dirt. Now, I want you to think about having to take even a tenth of an acre lot that's kind of crappy soil and turn it into something valuable that will grow things for you. Not just edible things, but habitat for the wildlife that you want to attract. Because we're going to talk today about attracting soil wildlife. We're going to talk about beneficial insects, butterflies, bats, things like that. and you've got this crappy piece of soil because it's basically been scraped sterile, and then maybe they threw sod down on it when they built it, and it's got an eighth of an inch of topsoil attached to that sod, and that's what it is, and that's all that it is. And you have this huge job to turn this into something valuable. Well, what if I could tell you how to get a million workers working for you 24/7 for free? Well, all you have to do is increase the organic matter on your property. That's it. Through sheet mulching, through composting, through soil amendments, whatever it is, increase the organic matter, specifically the decaying organic matter on your soil, and you'll attract something called earthworms. And on a tenth of an acre, you'll probably eventually attract a hell of a lot more than a million of them. Now, you can go to the store, and you can buy a little jug of worm castings, about a gallon milk-sized jug of worm castings, for about $15. And it's a good investment, because if you bring that home and you utilize it in proper ways to feed your soil, right, it'll do a lot of good for your soil. But how many worm castings do a million worms create in your backyard every single day, if that is out there and ongoing? So the first wildlife we want to attract to our property is soil creatures. And if we can attract a million soil creatures, which is, honestly, that could be attracted into a 20-square-foot area or less. So we're not just talking about worms. We're talking about beneficial nematodes. We're even talking about pest soil creatures. And think about how much wildlife is out there. Now, remember what I started with. If you're going to really appreciate what you're creating, you're going to have to start observing. So what I'd like you to do this year is when you walk your gardens, take a camera with you. Take pictures of insects. Take pictures of anything that you find that you don't know what it is. Maybe journal it, record it, look it up, learn what it is. Learn what the creature is and what niche it occupies and what it does. And learn the interrelationships. What does the animal need and what does it provide? See, that is the key to building strong wildlife habitat. That's the key to building a strong permaculture system. If we look at a worm, what does a worm need? It needs food. It needs moist soil. It needs a place that it can get out of the heat. And that's pretty much it. If there's organic matter that it's capable of consuming and it has moisture and it has a place that it can escape from the heat, worms will thrive. Period. Now, what does a worm produce? See, this is the other side. This is the part. Everybody always looks at the requirements of an animal, but nobody looks at its products. What does it provide? Well, worms provide worm castings. They provide food for birds that like to eat worms, like robins. So the robin is supported directly by the worm. The plants are supported indirectly by the worm. And the worm also consumes excess organic matter and helps it decay. So one of its outputs is actually decaying organic matter. That's why we start in the soil. As we move on from there, we have to think about what is the one thing that all living creatures need beyond food and beyond, you know, shelter. And that, of course, is water. It's the most important thing that we can possibly do to improve a property. I want you to think about multiple ways to add what I call water features to your property. Now, obviously, small ponds and things like that, or fountains, they're great. I think they belong on every piece of property. I think you should have one. I think they do a tremendous amount, both emotionally and ecologically, on your property. But what's more important than that is water that's utilized by plants and animals on your property beyond just standing water. So, yes, let's put in the pond. If it's a big piece of land, let's put it in an acre pond if we can. Let's put a half acre, a quarter acre. Let's put in a pond that's a few hundred feet in diameter. I don't care. Let's put in a pond. If it's a small backyard, let's put a little 20-foot by 15-foot pond on a particular area. Let's plant around it. Let's make it a little habitat for frogs and toads and stuff like that we'll get to in a minute. But let's also think about the fact that every time it rains, even if you live in a dry, arid environment, the massive amount of water that comes down off of your roof, the massive amount of water that your entire property collects, and how much of that water just runs away and does nothing. Water features aren't just about places that water stand. You can look and go, oh, look, there's water. What we have to understand about water, if we want to attract wildlife, we go back to building soil and building plant life up. That the slower water moves off property, the less of it eventually gets off the property, and the more of it stays put and gets utilized. So simply by changing the shape of our land through building things like rain gardens and swales, which I won't go deeply into today, other than to say a swale is a level ditch. If we build a dead level ditch, and it could be a very small feature, it'd be something that just looks like a little roll in your property. You don't even really realize what it's doing. And we do several of those with level overflows. And maybe we go into a few places and we dig out a place where water can be easily directed and collected. We dig out a hole and we fill it with loose organic matter. And we plant into that organic matter. So it just looks like a raised bed. But it actually becomes a water collection facility. And underneath that pile of mulch is actually a pond. Now, no one would look at it and see it as a pond, but if you observe it, you understand that's what it is. And now we're able to grow plants that need more moisture than are generally available in our area, even without continuously watering throughout the drier parts of the year, because we've actually planted the plants on top of a pond. It's just a pond where the water's contained within organic matter versus being completely contained and upheld by the ground. So this would be, you don't want to do packed clay with this. You want something that water can eventually seep out or overflow from, but you want a huge depth of organic matter, maybe 2-3 feet deep of organic matter, like a banana circle that the permaculturists do. If we slow down water, we make it more efficient. The next thing I want to do, I want to start going into some of the individual animals that we actually want to attract to your property. So let's look at some of the things that we can bring in by making small modifications. As long as we take care of our soil and make sure there's water and understand that we need to observe things, one of the biggest problems that people have today is bugs, specifically mosquitoes. Mosquitoes are the bane of existence. Of all of the creatures out there, the one that I despise is the mosquito. You're out at night enjoying yourself, having a barbecue, and all of a sudden, in your ear, and next thing you know, 20 of his buddies are harassing you, and your wife is slapping her arms and running into the house, and that night out on the deck is ruined by the mosquito, unless you spray yourself with smelly chemicals, which I will resort to. I'll use insect repellent, but I wish I didn't have to so much. So one of the things that you can attract to your property that will absolutely slay mosquitoes and other insects are bats. And it's a pretty easy thing to do in just about any area of the country where bats live. And all it really requires is installing some bat houses. Now, I've looked into this. I haven't installed any around here yet, mainly because I don't have really a good place for them. But there are some things that you need to think about when you're putting in a bat house. I recently did some consulting for a listener, and they had a bat house up on a tree. And they said that they had heard that maybe they made a mistake, that trees were not a good place for bat houses. They're actually a pretty decent place for bat houses. But here's some things that you have to do if you want your bat house to be effective. Number one, it must be a minimum of 10 feet off the ground, and higher is better. That's number one. Number two, if you're going to mount it to a tree, it needs to not be near limbs. Bats don't like limbs around any place that they're going to go roost because it makes their flying more difficult. They like a very open area, so you would want to use something like maybe a pine tree. Where you could prune it way up, maybe 12, 14, 18 feet up before it really is branching out, and put your bat house that high up would be a great way to do it. For those of you that are deer hunters with climbing tree stands, that would be a great way to get up there and mount your bat house if you have a tree that would work. You also want the house to be south-facing and hit by the sun. Bats like it warm. So you want it on the south or southeast side of the tree. You can also mount them to, if you have a two-story house, you can mount them to a house. Most one-story houses, I think you're going to have a problem with being high enough. Some people say, I don't want to mount a bat house to my house. Well, if you don't want to, fine, but don't be afraid to. Bats are cool little creatures. They won't hurt you. The other thing is, if you're putting it on a tree, it makes a lot of sense to ring that tree with some kind of metal flashing or some type of barrier. Once you have a bunch of little bats up there nesting and breeding baby bats and doing all the good things that bats do, they attract things like rat snakes, and rat snakes will go right into a bat house like that and absolutely clean it out. So will things like raccoons. So you want to give them some protection. But if you do that, hopefully you'll be lucky and you'll end up with a colony of bats living right in your backyard. And again, I know some people think that bats are kind of creepy and icky, but I tell you what, I was in Panama for over 2 years in the military. There were bats everywhere. The 6 months I did in Honduras, there were bats everywhere. We never had any problems. They never caused any problems. Occasionally, we actually had, they were nesting in the third floor eave of this building where the NCO club was. And occasionally, I'd say maybe once every 6 months, we'd end up with a bat flying around the bar room. And everybody'd run around, and usually some guy that was there in his fatigues would take off his BDU cap, and we'd use it to capture the bat, take it outside, and let it go. There's never any issues there, so you shouldn't really be afraid of them. I know people worry about them being rabies carriers, but you only end up getting rabies from an animal that you have direct physical contact with. And I've just never really seen a bat looking for a lot of physical contact with human beings. I see them as just like any other creature. I would worry more about a rodent like a squirrel if I was going to worry about rabies than a bat. All right, so moving on from bats, hopefully that's something you can bring in. Let's start talking about bringing in beneficial insects, everything from pollinators to predators. What I want to kind of point out to you is there is almost no pest insect that is attracted by a flowering herb. And that's everything from basil and rosemary to lavender to calendula to, you know, anything you can think of that's an herb that flowers, and even herbs that don't flower. Parsley, oregano, I guess, sort of flowers eventually, sage, all of the stuff, all of the herbs, sorrel, you name it, whatever you can think of that qualifies as specifically a medicinal or culinary herb, and specifically those items that flower. Chamomile is another great example. If you plant stuff like that, and I don't mean like one here and one there. I mean little clumps of multi-dimensional herbs. So that you're working with things like a little clump, and in that clump is chamomile and calendula, which is known as pot marigold, and maybe some echinacea and some aslum and some other things that just have a little very clump. You'll have all kinds of little pollinators and predatory wasps in that little clump. And that's what I want to point out is that it's great to have a great big focal point herb garden. Maybe you do the permaculture thing and you put in what's called an herb spiral. And I won't really get deep into that because I only have so much time to do it in one show. But you put that herb spiral in, and that's a great way to maximize space. But in the end, having a bunch of small herb gardens is going to be much more beneficial and effective than having one great big one. So even if you have that big one, I want you planting little clumps of herbs and flowering herbs and other things that you can eat. Remember, all of your vegetables, all of your edibles don't need to be sitting in 4 foot by 4 foot raised beds. You can go out, and plant runner beans along your fence, just straight into the ground with very little prep whatsoever, but plant some herbs around there as well. Instead of going by and weed-eating all along your fence line every time you have to mow whatever part of your lawn is left after I get done, you know, incentivizing you to kill it, why not all along every fence you possibly can not plant bordering herbs that maybe need a little bit of trimming and things like that once in a while, and a little bit of harvesting and some vegetables and things like that, and then just mow past them instead of having to take that weed eater out and do more work to weed eat than you do to mow. And I think that's what most Americans do. They spend half of their weekend weed eating everywhere. What an annoying thing. When all of that space could be used to plant plants that are actually beneficial that you just want to continue growing. Here's the thing to remember about weeds and grass. If you plant enough of beneficial things that you want, there's no room left for them. So you could literally go by, especially the sunny fence lines that you have, and just put in a layer of mulch. Put down a strip, get some cardboard boxes, lay a strip a foot long all the way along that sunny fence line. Put mulch on top of it. Whenever you find a plant, you're going to plant in there, and it's not really that great for starting seeds, but things like beans, you can start in things like, they'll come up through there. Go in, cut a hole in that piece of cardboard, dig a little hole, shove your plant in, push the mulch back around until you completely fill all your sunny fence lines with herbs and other edibles. I mean, you could do things like start things like orach and lamb's quarter and anything that you want to plant. You can plant a tomato along a fence line if you want to. You just need to give it something to trellis on. And I don't really recommend that you have anything trellising on your fence. If it's metal, it gets too high. What is a really good idea is to get lattice for anything you want to trellis, put some hooks on it, and put some standoffs on it, and stand it a couple inches off the fence and hang it over the top and let your trellising plants trellis up there. And go ahead and plant your ornamentals along that way, too. Roses, especially climbing roses and all these other things. So that the entire edge of your property actually becomes a real edge. When you get into places where you're heavily shaded, plant things that grow in the shade, ferns, English ivies, and things like that. And you'll start to have this huge arsenal come to your property of beneficial insects. Folks, you have to understand, there's billions of these things flying around your city right now. All you have to do is make your little oasis more attractive to them than your neighbors, which really isn't that hard the way most Americans run their yards. And they'll swarm there. You add water, and you have good soil, and you've got things really starting to cook. The next thing to understand is there's room for at least a patch of true wilderness on every piece of property. I don't care if you have 1/20th of an acre postage stamp. Rope off 2 square feet. Put a little place up there to mark it so you know that not to touch it. And if you have somebody help you with garbage, they don't have to touch it. And leave it alone. Just let whatever happens, happens. As it extends beyond the place that you're comfortable with it, cut it back. But in that area, let it be whatever it is going to be. Let whatever is going to grow, grow. And you'll be amazed at what that little patch will do. It's a place to shelter predators and to shelter wildlife. I also want you to think about the fact that we have this compulsion to think about wildlife as being the higher animal species. So we think about squirrels and birds and things like that, and they're great. And as I'm talking to you right now, I'm sitting in my office looking through my window watching a fox squirrel hang upside down from one of my feeders eating all my black-oiled sunflowers that are mostly there for the birds. And he's welcome here, and he's a great part of the show today that he's here with me while I'm doing it. And I'm watching some birds, so I am all about them. I'm not putting them down. Again, we'll talk about them a little bit at the end. But because we focus on that, and that's what we see as wildlife, we don't think about other things like, oh, I don't know, frogs and toads. Now, with true frogs, we definitely need an open water feature, a pond of some sort. Very beneficial for toads as well, because they need it for breeding. But for true frogs, we need a pond. But we don't necessarily have to have great big bullfrogs. It maybe would annoy the neighbors if we live in the city and they don't really have enough space to grow because we're in this small suburban lot. Now, if you're in a big pond, hey, man, you want all the bullfrogs you can get. They're good eating things, right? But the smaller species of true frogs, a small pond with a few of those guys kind of stocked. So this can be you go out and into the like kind of native habitat around you and look for them and find them and bring them home or possibly purchase them. You got to be careful with that with exotic species and things like that. But odds are if you have a pond in the middle of suburbia and you don't have a lot of neighbors doing the same thing, they're not going anywhere anyway. But you got to be careful with don't break the law. Let me just leave it at that. But you start adding some frogs. Or if you live in an area where somewhere around, they'll be attracted by it anyway. But the species that really belongs in the backyard of suburbia, everywhere where the climate is appropriate for it to live. So this probably ain't going to work in Phoenix, Arizona, to be fair. Or if you're up in northern Alberta, Canada, I don't know that these guys are up there. I don't think they are. But the American toad is the prince of your garden if you live anywhere where he can live. Now, what does he need? Let's think, again, let's interrelationships here. And I should probably do more shows about just certain species and their interrelationships. A toad needs a place to shelter from the heat. He also needs moisture, but not as much as a frog or, let's say, a worm does. He needs food. That is generally not a problem anywhere because there's insects everywhere. But he'll be much better off in an environment like I've been describing today because there'll be a lot of variety. No creature really does well on one source of food. They want multiple sources of food. It is just a more healthy, balanced diet for any creature to have multiple food sources. And if there's any toxicity to any food source, it's mitigated because it's spread out. So he needs a multiple food source. What does he like to eat? He likes to eat things like slugs and worms. He loves to eat those two things. He also likes to eat just about any insect that he can get into his little toad mouth. His biggest need is shelter from the heat and a place to hide from anything that he would perceive as a predator. So how do we attract toads to our property or create an environment where if we go out and find them somewhere and introduce them, they stick around? We need a shaded spot, and we need toad houses. We don't need toad houses, but boy, are they a good way to go. So you can go out and buy these little cute little house things that look like a little house that ladies like, that little frog sitting there, you know, on his porch drinking moonshine or whatever. Or you can go out and buy terracotta pots for about $2 that are big enough to house a toad or two, and you can kind of scribe a little doorway, and then you can knock that out with a hammer, and you can set that somewhere, and it's a perfect little air-conditioned frog house. You put about 10 of these on any property, even a small property, and it'll greatly increase their frog habitat. Now, how can you make this even more effective? Make sure that it's a shaded area. In those shaded areas, plant things that will grow well in shaded areas, such as English ivy and ferns. Put these near your water features if you can find a shaded area near your water feature, or build your water features close access to shaded areas and put your frog houses there. If you're really smart, you'll kind of put a strip of herbs and other plantings that are useful to you between your shaded area and your pond. This gives the frog access and predator habitat between the pond and where he stays. He's more likely to venture across it. Locate spots of shade and frog housing near your garden as well. If you want the frog to go to your garden, don't make him hop, you know, half an acre to get there. Find some places or create some shade. So plant some trees. Underneath those trees, you have shade. Now build frog habitat. Now, the other thing that I'm going to tell you, again, there could be some wildlife laws and things you have to worry about. As a kid, though, I did this all the time. There was an apartment complex near where my grandparents lived, and I had these frog houses all over the place. And I had like three frogs when I first set them up. And I'm like, I want frogs fast. So I went to this apartment complex, and they all had the rain downspouts, and under each downspout, I'd already learned this just because kids look at everything, there were those big concrete slab things that make the water not erode the ground and take the water away instead of utilizing it effectively. And if you lifted them up, a few of them were like flat to the ground, and like there's nothing could get under there. But a lot of them had some space under them, and every one that had space under them were full of toads. So I went down there one day, and I got this little box, a little cage box. And I came back, I had to have 50 toads, and I let those suckers go all over my grandparents' yard. And there were frogs there forever after that, or toads, I should say, there. And you know what? They do a great job of helping control the insects. So the frog has those needs. Well, what is his output? Well, believe it or not, if you have 50 toads running around your property, that's quite a bit of toad manure. And it's a high-quality manure source. They're not really food for a lot of things, so you do. At some point, you may end up transporting a few of them away because they don't really get predated on much. Frogs do, but toads have this this chemical that comes out of their skin. If you've ever seen a puppy see his first American toad, he'll immediately grab it in his mouth, spit it out, and probably never pick one up again. It stays with them that long, so. They don't really have a lot of predators, but they will balance their population because there'll only be as many toads as there is food for them. So there's a lot that can be done with just the old American toad. Again, this is something to think about beyond what we usually think about when we think about attacking wildlife. Kind of in the same niche, I'm really big on lizards and geckos, again, everywhere that they'll live. When my grandparents up in Pennsylvania had no way that we're going to be any lizards or geckos on the property. It was just too cold of an environment. I never saw a lizard there. Saw a lot of salamanders. And they're another great thing to bring in. So if you're in the northern climates where you don't really have lizards and geckos, you can create salamander habitat, which is obviously not much different than frog and toad habitat. Now in the south, though, I've made a habit. We have these little things called Mediterranean geckos around here. They are an invasive species, if you like to use that term. But they're invasive to the point where they're everywhere. And whenever I'm somewhere and I see one of the little guys, especially if I'm wearing a shirt like with a breast pocket where it can be buttoned up and it's a nice little place for the guy, I'll catch him, stick him in there, I bring him home, and I let him go on my shed or on my deck. There is a tremendous amount of benefit that comes from having geckos and lizards. I've really looked at trying to attract more lizards to the property. There are some American anoles in the Texas area, but I think most of those are came from released pets. But they do seem to survive fairly well in the places that I've seen them, but I haven't really made an effort to relocate them to my property. Up in Arkansas, we kind of move into a different kind of lizard that I've seen around a lot, and it's called a blue-bellied swift or a fence lizard. And if you can Google them and take a look at blue-bellied swift, and there's quite a few of those around, and whenever we go hiking, if I find one, he comes home. And I just, and again, I know some people are going to say, this is illegal or whatever. I mean, I can't find any law that makes it illegal to transport a native creature a mile or so and release it to habitat where he's already native. And if there is such a law, I prefer not to know about it. But what we're talking about here, again, is native animals. We're not talking about going down to the pet store and buying 12 Madagascar chameleons and letting them go in your backyard, which they'd probably die anyway. But just to be clear, what we're talking about is not introducing species, but simply taking native species that are native to the area and physically moving them. You don't really have to do that. If you put the habitat in, they'll show up. The problem with that is often that you've created this wonderful habitat, and you're surrounded by 1,000 acres of pristine, sterile monocultured lawn with very few trees other than sterile pear trees, and that wildlife, when we start to look at things like snakes, frogs, toads, and things like that, just doesn't even have any idea that the habitat's there. There's no pathway for them to get there. So that's why a lot of times those areas aren't colonized and why it helps to kind of help Mother Nature along a little bit. I just mentioned snakes. Are snakes good to have around? I would tell you absolutely yes. I don't like rattlesnakes and copperheads on my property because I have dogs, and up until recently I had young children. Now my boy's grown, and his friends have come over old enough to know what to do with the snake and stay away from it. So I really am less concerned, but I'm still concerned for my dogs, obviously. One thing you should know, there is a rattlesnake vaccine for dogs. It's quite effective, and you might want to consider getting any dog that lives out in the country or might come into contact with rattlesnakes that vaccine. Florida, we had a lot of cottonmouths or moccasins, depending on what you want to call them. And I never really had a lot of problem with them because they really kind of stayed down mostly by the water's edge, and you did have to be careful. But I've been around a lot of venomous snakes, and I don't have a fear for them. I have a respect for them. But I really don't like the concept of definitely not introducing and certainly not trying to attract venomous reptiles to my property. In fact, I've done removals for quite a few people where they'll phone me up and say, hey, I got a rattlesnake. And I'll go get it, and I'll remove it, and I'll take it somewhere away from populated areas and release it, because I don't like to kill snakes unless I absolutely have to, or I'm hungry. They do make good eating. But I'm talking about non-venomous snakes. And the only reason I haven't encouraged, let's say, a few rat snakes to be in my backyard here is I know eventually they'll wander out into the surrounding properties, and my neighbors will kill them, because my neighbors are idiots. Because most people that just kill a snake because it's a snake are idiots. And if that's you, I'm sorry today, you're getting called an idiot. Because you're killing something with no rationale whatsoever. You think about a rat snake, and it has a head about maybe the size of your thumb, maybe twice the size of your thumb. It has these little tiny teeth. The only way it's going to bite you is if you go grab it and start messing around with it. And then even if it bites you, it's not that big a deal. But you'll be afraid of that snake. Then you'll turn around and pet a cat. The average house cat can inflict so much more damage to you than something like a rat snake or a corn snake. But I'm even talking about, like, do I have snakes in the middle of Arlington, Texas on my property, other than the ones in my enclosures in my room? Absolutely, I have wild snakes here. They're little brown earth snakes. And I found them anywhere from about 4 inches long to some fairly large ones for the species, up to about a foot long. And the foot long ones are about as big around as my little finger. And you know where I find them? I find them in my garden all the time. When I'm turning mulch over, or when I'm turning over things that were left laying around. And I'm not even sure what these guys eat. I know they eat spider mites, and when they're really small, they probably eat worms, but they're out there, and they don't bother me at all. And I think that a lot of people around here probably have them in their backyards, and because they never bother to do things like mulch or turn things over, they don't even know they're there, and I prefer they didn't, because I know a few people who have killed them. Again, out of being idiots. I mean, you're talking about a creature now that really couldn't, their mouths are so small they could barely bite you if they tried. And I've picked up every one I've ever seen just to check it out. I've never seen one try to bite. They look more like a big worm than a snake when you first see them. But they're really cool. And I think there's a place for all of those things on your property, including the higher level snakes, milk snakes and rat snakes, that help control rodents. Because I feed the birds and squirrels, I've got a few rats that have been, cotton rats have taken up residence under my deck, and I've been trapping them out. I would much prefer, if it wasn't going to end up costing a snake its life, to go out and find a wild rat snake somewhere, capture them, bring them home, and send them under that deck. Because within 3 weeks, there wouldn't be a rat under there. They'll go in and they'll not just take out the parents, they'll go in and nest, and they'll clean out the nests. So a couple rat snakes would handle that for me, and I've been dealing with them for a while now. And they're not really a problem, and they're also part of the ecosystem, but they have a propensity to overbreed. So I've been trapping them out and feeding them to my pythons. But there are all types of creatures out there, and there's places for all of them on your property. Let's move up to some higher level animals, and let's think about what they need and what their place in the ecosystem is. Squirrels. What do squirrels need? Well, if you want squirrels to be sustainable, and that's the big thing here, we're not just talking about attracting wildlife. Plenty of people put out feeders, right? Here comes a squirrel, here comes a bird, and the bird comes and it takes some food and it leaves. It doesn't really live on your property. It doesn't really hang out on your property. It just comes to get the food and it goes away. If you want populations to be sustainable, beyond food, you need to provide shelter, cover, and water. If you provide food, shelter, cover, and water, you provide the habitat that any creature needs. You can do that with squirrels quite easily. One is by not removing all your trees, leaving some older trees, especially hardwoods, that have places for them to nest, and provide nesting boxes. Also, by remember I talked about having little pathways between where the frog habitat is and the pond? Because some of the toads weren't going to live right next to the pond, but they needed that little toad house. But they also wanted to come over to the pond at night and eat mosquitoes and things like that. That same type of situation creates kind of places where squirrels can move across the ground undercover and they feel a lot safer that way. So that's important for squirrels. What are the outputs of a squirrel, though? I guess they put out a little bit of manure here and there and they spread that around. But they also have a habit, and the habit is digging. And that digging habitat actually helps turn your soil. They also will plant things. They take their, you know, hundreds and thousands of acorns every year and plant them, and they only remember where maybe 10% of them are to go back and eat them if they ever do that, because I find little oak trees popping up all over my property that, you know, I have to get rid of. But if I was on a larger piece of property, that would actually be a benefit. My biggest view of what a squirrel's output is in your ecosystem is if you're inclined to harvest them, they are a source of protein. So you give them what they need, and they feed you a few times a year. And the beautiful thing about squirrels is unless you get stupid with it and just like shooting all of them on sight, it's almost impossible to overhunt squirrel populations because of the way they breed and because of the natural way that they control their own population. In bad mast years, you'll see very few squirrels. They reproduce at lower levels. In good mast years, they reproduce at higher levels. So they're a very self-adjusting creature. That's why they've been so successful, as the little guy looks at me again and wonders when he's going to end up in a pot of squirrels too. Next, rabbits. If you want rabbits on your property, here's what I've got to tell you. You need to give them shelter, just like the squirrel has to have, places to nest. But the big thing they need are to be protected from dogs and cats. If you give them an area where they're relatively protected from dogs and cats, and plant clover, you live in an area where rabbits live, you will have rabbits, and you will have lots of rabbits, and you have the same inputs and outputs and a lot of the same characteristics as a squirrel, with the exception that they don't, you know, spend time up in trees. The next thing I want to start talking about is birds, because as people try to attract birds, they generally do the same thing that they do to try to attract squirrels. We feed them. Maybe we put up a birdhouse or two, but most birdhouses that you buy in the store are not the right dimensions, or if they are, they're dimensions for a bird that's not even living in your area anymore. A lot of birdhouses are built in dimensions that are perfect for a bluebird. Great if you live where bluebirds live, but if you don't live where bluebirds live, not many other birds will actually utilize that space because it's dimensionally perfect for the bluebird. A lot of them are built that are really nice for wrens, or like Jenny wrens and birds like that. Well, that's a pretty small bird, and if you don't have a bird like that that prefers that type of habitat, it won't do a lot of good. So feeding, again, we bring the birds in, they leave, we put some water features out, maybe a bird bath or a pond, they come and they drink and they leave. And that's great, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's so limiting. Bird habitat is so much more effective than bird feeding. So what's bird habitat? Well, all the stuff we've already talked about is bird habitat. Remember, because it starts on the soil. But there's some other things that we can do. Insect-eating birds are the most valuable things that you can attract to your property to help control pests, even more so than frogs, toads, lizards, and bats. Insect-eating birds are absolutely one of the premier things you can bring in to control the insect population on your property. Now, what most people don't realize is that most insectivore birds really need a good perching place. And if you're at a point where your trees are really young and you don't have good perching environments in your trees, then what you want to do is give them a place to perch. So what you do is you place a pole with a little perch right next to the tree, so it is kind of concealed by the tree, but you keep doing that until the tree is maybe 10 to 12 feet high and has lots of perching branches. And then all of a sudden, birds like catbirds and mockingbirds and blue jays, believe it or not, even though they eat a lot of seeds, they're an omnivore. They're a big insect predator, and things like that will start showing up. But until you give them that perch environment, they don't feel safe, So they bypass and they go someplace where that environment exists. Whenever you're looking at attracting wildlife, it's about providing them the environment they're looking for. So a couple poles on your property near bushes or trees with a little perch environment at the top, with a little bit of concealment around it, will start to bring in the mockingbirds and the other birds that will actually predate on the insects on your property. The other thing, they definitely need to have water. And the more cover, the better. So the more bushes and shrubs and trees. And don't just plant food for yourself. Plant food for the wildlife. So there are quite a few berries out there that maybe are bland or edible. You wouldn't really want them, but birds really enjoy them. And then there's berries that you could plant that grow so heavily that if the birds take some, you don't care. But the more habitat you create, the more wildlife that you will attract. So that's kind of one of the last things I wanted to talk to you about today was the bird perch, which is just something that nobody ever thinks of. And all these great ideas, you know, where they usually come from, Bill Mollison. I read that in a transcript by Mollison, and I thought, wow, I never really thought about it. But, yeah, these birds like that, the wrens, the catbirds, the mockingbirds, they all, you always see them. They come flying in, and they perch on something, and then they look, and they watch. And then when they see something, they want to attack, and they have amazing eyesight. I've seen mockingbirds sitting in a tree and hone in on something, you know, 100 feet away and fly down and grab it. And 100 feet doesn't sound that far, but you have to think that they're looking at an insect crawling through grass. And that's amazing that they can see that well. And that's why they're part of your army. And there's so many more things you can do. Let's think about some other things we can do that are really simple and often overlooked. Let's say we put in a nice little pond. Let's say it's 20 feet long by 10 foot wide, something in that neighborhood. And we have koi in it, or goldfish, or even catfish. We have a little fish pond out there. We need to feed our fish. Now, we're not going to have any insect problems in that pond if it's well-stocked, because they're going to eat all the insects. But they're only going to eat the insects that go there. So what can we do to feed them all throughout the warm part of the year for basically free? Well, what we do is we go down to like Walmart or one of the box stores. We buy an insect light, one of those zapper lights. We suspend it over the center of the pond. And we just run it for maybe 3 hours a night, that last hour of twilight and the first 2 hours of darkness. If you ever run a bug zapper, once you get, you know, beyond the first few hours of darkness, the amount of bugs that seem to get zapped go way down. So why spend the electricity all night? And they run a fluorescent light, so they're very low draw in the first place. So we set that up on a timer that is just about an hour before light is over, it comes on, and it runs till about 2 hours into the darkness, and it goes off. There will literally be a half a pound of mosquitoes and various insects fried and dropped into and served to your fish. And all of that is free food for the fish. Now, you have to watch it because if you don't have enough fish to eat it all, you might have to reduce the amount of time, or you might even extend it a little bit if your insect activity runs later into the evening, depending on how many fish you have and how big the pond is. I've seen people do it with two lights over one pond and run them for 4 hours, and that worked fairly well, but they had a large pond and a lot of fish. But isn't it amazing that we're going to go to the store and buy pelletized fish food to feed our fish? And not that you wouldn't still do that some. Most ponds will still require some supplemental feeding, even in, you know, insect activity periods of the year. But we would go out and do that when there's a simple solution like hanging a light over the pond. In fact, you don't even have to hang a bug light. If you hang just a light over the pond, a lot of those bugs will just run into it and end up down in the water. So you can take like a mechanic's light that, you know, has the reflector around it and a simple light bulb. But I really kind of think bug zappers are neat. I know it's a redneck thing to drink a beer and watch bugs fry, but it is fun. And it's cool. And you know what? Those bugs are a natural prey for the fish, and it's not bringing in an insecticide or something like that. So I know this is different. Maybe you thought today we were going to talk about deer and elk and bear, and we went on this kind of biology lesson. But here's the thing, folks. If you don't understand the underlying principles of how to create habitat, then all you're doing is, it's like being a doctor. The patient comes in, I've got a headache. Here's an aspirin, go home. Patient comes in, I have a stomachache, here's some Pepto-Bismol, go home, or the prescription versions thereof. Without actually saying, well, what caused the stomachache? You know, maybe the stomachache wasn't caused by something you ate. Maybe you have a deep underlying problem that's going to kill you someday if I don't figure it out. Maybe the headache is because you're having the beginnings of a brain aneurysm. Gee, I better at least check your vital signs and see if anything's going on. I think most of us in this kind of, you know, modern survival niche that have understood that there's better ways to do things that a lot of what modern society does. Not that everything about modern society is bad. Hey, I've always said if I get in a wreck and I have a yield sign on my spleen, please take me to the nearest surgeon as quickly as possible because he might be able to save my life. But we also are somewhat critical of the medical industry, and specifically the pharmaceutical industry, and this concept of we have a pain or an ache or an uneasiness, and we have a pill that matches it, and we just stick the two together, and we go on with life. But then we turn around and we manage our backyards that way. I don't have any squirrels or birds, so I'll put some feeders in. Oh, now I have squirrels and birds all as well. But all you have are passers-by. You don't have any residents. And that's what I wanted to give you today, is a way to create a habitat that would make this wildlife into residents of your property, or at least nearby residents. If you give, like, you can only, let's say you have a tenth of an acre, or a 20th of an acre, two-tenths of an acre, I'm sorry, or a third of an acre, or even an acre, right? A pretty big lot for anywhere in suburbia is an acre. That's really big. A lot of places do have half-acre lots. A half-acre lot's a pretty nice-sized lot. I have a third. It's a pretty decent-sized lot, but I have a carrying capacity. I only have so many animals that can live on my property. But if I create a good enough habitat for those animals, then what they'll do is they'll take up residence in the nearest available place that will support their needs, and that I will become a place they're constantly coming back to. And we've been able to do that quite a bit in our backyard. But the big thing I want to leave you with today, I want you to commit to yourself this year to pay more attention. Most of you guys are going to be out gardening. And I don't care if it's container gardening on a back porch or gardening on a small micro farm or even a large farm or a typical suburban lot. If you're going to be out gardening and you're going to be doing things to improve the habitat, if you're going to be feeding the soil, you're going to be creating wildlife habitat. You're going to be having all kinds of little bugs and insects and crawly things showing up. Don't just look at them and go, huh. Look at it and watch its behavior. Pay attention to what it does. Is it eating your leaves? Well, then it's a pest insect. Pay attention to the little wasps. What do they do? What plants are they attracted to? When you start to, and then look the plant, the animals up. Take pictures. Post them to the forum. Share them with people. Say, hey, I don't know what this is. Tell me what this is. If you can't find it. If you do know what it is, post it to our forum and say, I know what this is. Here's what it does. And then when you see a creature that is a pest insect, find out what eats it. Find out what consumes it and create habitat for its predator. Right? And obviously you're already halfway there, because what does the predator need? Food, shelter, and water. Right? Well, it's already got food. It's probably got shelter, right? And all you have to do is figure out, well, what are the other shelter-type things that it likes? So a lot of solitary wasps and the little predatory wasps, right, they might predate on a lot of the pest insects, but they also like pollen. So you have to give them herb gardens, and that will bring them in. But pay attention to those interrelationships. When you see one animal eat another animal, identify both species. When you see birds show up and you look at a bird and go, I don't really know what that bird is, go look it up. There's a great iPhone application for identifying birds. I'll see if I can find it today. I haven't been able to find it with my new iPhone, but I'll try looking for it online. But where you just put a few characteristics of a bird and learn what kind of bird it is. You know, if you see a frog or a toad or a snake, don't squash it. Figure out what it is. If it's venomous, and there are only a couple venomous snakes in the United States, folks. You have rattlesnakes. There's about 18 species of rattlesnakes. But a rattlesnake is a rattlesnake is a rattlesnake, and they're pretty damn easy to identify. You have copperheads, you have water moccasins or cottonmouths, depending on what part of the country you are from, and you have coral snakes. And coral snakes are probably the most venomous and least dangerous of them all. If you get bit by a coral snake, you really have to bother it. They have very small mouths, and they're not very aggressive animals, and if you leave them alone, they won't bother you. That can be said for all snakes, but you know what? You can step somewhere and aggravate a rattlesnake that was resting and didn't know you were coming and didn't have time to flee, and it could bite you on the leg. The same with a cottonmouth, the same with a copperhead. I myself was bitten by a copperhead as a teenager when I stepped on its back. Just not going to happen with a coral snake unless maybe you're barefoot and you step on it with your toes. All right, so it's really those three that you have to look out for, rattlesnakes, cottonmouths, and copperheads. And a lot of you live in places in the country where there's no copperheads and there's no cottonmouths. The only thing you have to look for is a rattlesnake. So learn what that is. And if it's not one of those, leave it alone. It's not going to hurt anything. It's a valuable member of your community. and it has it's occupying a space. And if you have rat snakes around your property, whether you want to admit it or not, that means you have rats or other rodents on your property. Because if there wasn't any food for that animal, it wouldn't be there. And the bigger it is, the bigger your problem. And by removing it, the bigger you create of a problem. Now you're going to have a bigger problem because you've taken away the top predator. So leave those creatures be. But really look for the interrelationships. Start asking yourself, that one little cool-looking wasp, right? And I'm not talking about the big red things that sting you. I'm talking about the little guys that cruise around in your garden. Watch the different plants he goes to. Watch the way he responds to shade, to wind, and to other creatures around him. Look for mason bees. Plant lots of sunflowers this year. Nothing brings in bees, both mason bees and honeybees, like sunflowers. They're probably the biggest magnet you can put out there for them. There are a couple sunflowers that are pollen-free. Don't buy those. Right? You want the ones that are going to bring in a massive amount of bees. But pay attention this year. Journal. Learn. And keep developing habitat. And you can develop the habitat on the roof of a condo in the downtown city or out on a farm in the country. But it's always going to start with soil, even if that soil is in a container. And the more valuable you make your soil, the more rich the habitat you'll have is. And what does all this have to do with modern survivalism? If you have a backyard like I've described, you have an unending amount of protein source, and you have an ability to keep plants growing throughout most of the year, and you can feed yourself. But the other thing is, I've always said from the very beginning with this show, it is not about surviving disasters alone. It's about living your life in a way that makes it better even if nothing goes wrong. A piece of property like this is what I started out with. We have a desire to be surrounded by wild things. It feeds the soul, however you define it. And when you're happy and when you're positive and when your outlook is good, you're better able to deal with day-to-day stress or the biggest disaster that ever comes and hits you. That's why we take vacations to recharge. I'm suggesting that if you build the right type of property, you can have many vacations on a daily basis just by walking through your own little backyard. This has been Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
You can scream, you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.